One of the pleasures of my teaching and curatorial work in museums and universities has been welcoming young budding scholars to the table. Our research and thinking together has always been enjoyable. Today's conversation kicks off a series with young scholars on themes I've been privileged to work on with each of them. In the last number of months, Callum McCracken has joined me in exploring the rise of Christian nationalism. Since I have always been a bit cautious in studying the diseases of religion, culture, and society, not wanting to catch the infection, I decided we would begin our work and this conversation considering the civil rights movement that animated much of the 1960s, and think about how religion was at play in the gifts it bequeathed to our society. We would then move on to thinking about how the same texts and narratives and similar theological ideas can also be at work in the rise of Christian nationalism. Callum's undergraduate studies focused on political philosophy. He's now off to graduate school and will be working on issues of human rights on the international stage. My conversation with Callum began during his undergraduate studies. We talked about his interests in the political life of a number of countries, on international relations, and the issues of human rights as both a civil gift and a challenge for some cultural communities. We've also talked about the difficult issues often found in the public square and how we might deepen public understanding across the usual political silos. Several years ago, Callum did a lovely piece of research for me, exploring culture, pluralism, and human rights, focusing on how this theme unfolded in Quebec and the work of Charles Taylor on this issue. He was also engaged by the Commonwealth Human Rights Initiative, and I had the pleasure of discussing some of his work and having larger conversations with him on international challenges we face, given the legacy of colonialism. We begin these three podcasts thinking about his own intellectual growth over the last few years. We explore the civil rights movement, the place of religion and religious ideas in the growth of this movement, with particular emphasis on the prophetic tradition. We touch on the work of Dr. Martin Luther King, the way he drew on the thinking of Reinhold Niebuhr and Gandhi. We touch on the work of Malcolm X and Dorothy Day and the political landscape in which they worked and which they sought to transform. In our next podcast, we will explore the policy changes in the United States that endeavored to address racism and poverty. And our third podcast digs into the roots of Christian nationalism and its current rise in liberal democratic societies. Welcome to our conversation. So, Callum, you've been working with me. We've actually been looking towards doing work on Christian nationalism.
That's right.
And I know that in your education and your kind of intellectual sensibilities, you have, how can I put this? You haven't had an entirely favorable view of the place of religion in human culture and society. Is it fair for me to say that?
That's yeah, more than fair. I definitely come from a sort of classical, sort of rational or hyper-rational, I would say, education, where I definitely viewed religion as more of a disease than a cure. I have since come to change that opinion.
And because I was interested in having you work with me so that I could, you know, we could look more deeply into this the rise of Christian nationalism, which we see a bit in the United States, we see it in Russia, we see it in Hungary, and what have you. But it occurred to me, since I have tried in my life to not
spend all my time on diseases, mm-hmm. but to spend my time around things that I love, things that I appreciate, things that have been meaningful, not just in my life, but which seem to me to be meaningful in human society and human culture. I thought it might be good, and also given your intellectual landscape, might be good if we began this work together by, for me, I suppose, revisiting the civil rights movement in the United States and looking at a movement which I think it's fair to say the vast majority of people would see as a as an attempt at seriously addressing issues of racism, poverty, marginalization in our neighbor to the south. And of course, it bleeds into Canada as well. And then looking at the place of religion within it, both the formation of a number of its leaders, as well as the institutions that were involved in it, and then the development of the kind of legislation which has made a huge difference. People say never enough, of course, but has made a huge difference in what has happened since 1860 mm-hmm. in the United States and the end of slavery, certainly as something that's acceptable within the civil sphere. So I was interested in, as we begin to walk into this a little bit, just in hearing a little bit about your, I mean, you do such good work, and I've appreciated it so much.
Thank you.
And with considerable depth. So I'd be interested in your reflecting a little bit on what has, just in a general way, what has surprised you? Are there things that have been a bit of a discovery for you around how religion works in particularly here in the civil rights movement? What's been striking to you?
Yeah, well, I suppose I came from it from a background of political science, as you well know. So I definitely come from a more secular understanding of these movements. I've looked into the legislation, obviously the historical significance of these movements, but my research, what surprised me, or what I found the most interesting, is how these faith movements colored and textured these understandings and made the civil rights movement move. What I found most interesting are the permutations of how people understood religion and how the idea of the prophetic tradition influenced these civil rights figures like Martin Luther King. I really looked into Reinhold Niebuhr and his influence on multiple figures and so on.
Mm-hmm. So the prophetic tradition, when we use that term, we really are referring to the way in which, for the biblical Jewish tradition, I mean, it's always been so interesting to me that within the biblical tradition, there were two guilds. There was the guild of prophets and the guild of priests. This is during the temple period. And the guild of prophets, I've always seen them, I'm not alone at this. That's really the roots of our tradition of social criticism.
Mm-hmm.
They were, in some sense, the sociologists of the day and the political activists of the day. They read the Riot Act to the king. They read the Riot Act to the imperial order that, in the case of the Jewish community, when they were taken into slavery in Egypt or into Babylon, they read the Riot Act to the leaders there as well. They also would occasionally read the Riot Act to their own kings, their own leaders, mm-hmm. and also to the clergy, to the priesthood. So we have in the Bible, we have those amazing prophetic books, which sort of map that kind of critique, the writings of Jeremiah and Isaiah, Amos, Hosea, Obadiah. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are amazing figures in that great taproot of the West that goes back to Jerusalem. What is, so interesting about them is that they on the one hand critique the problem, but they also are saying that human dignity requires you to recognize widows and orphans, to recognize the stranger, to recognize others who you may not even understand as sharing in the human dignity. And this, of course, is at the heart of people like King, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, during my research, I looked into a lot of his early writings where he sort of sounded out and articulated these ideas, particularly as related to Jeremiah, where, as we all know, Jeremiah was a critic of the society that he lived in Israel. And people, he thought that people had broken the covenant to basically the dismay of the impoverished classes. So basically, he understood that story as an institutional critique, and he used it to animate his political understanding as he articulated, as he saw it in the civil rights movement, to that covenant that Jeremiah saw that the leaders in Israel broke. He wanted to rewrite and recreate and inscribe on the hearts of men, much in the vein of Jeremiah.
Yeah. And King himself, I mean, he was raised as a Baptist, huh? And you have Baptists in your family.
I do.
Yeah. In fact, if I recall, your grandparents on one side of your family were Baptist missionaries.
That's true.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
So that's kind of part of your patrimony.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see your past coming to meet you from the future here at all?
Yeah. It tends to sneak up on me from here and there.
Yeah. So King goes to seminary. He studies. He gets imbued with this prophetic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
He's a black man. He's a black preacher. He has an amazing rhetorical gift. And he goes to bat for the black community in the States. Is there an example that you can draw forth where you see him beginning to do this with great vigor?
Well, I mean, he started the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, right? So he began to organize in earnest in the South, particularly in the Birmingham demonstrations and onward. He basically drew upon earlier protests and student protests that were happening in the area, and used the incredible faith community that resided in the South, and used the energy and the spiritual energy of that to sort of reiterate these prophetic sort of truths that that the temple, as it were, was just a symbol of empty formalism and it didn't mean anything. The distinction between good and evil that the temple or the institutions of segregation, in this instance, they defied this covenant, and he was using this colorful religious language to inspire and move the people in the South and later on the North, as he had success with segregation laws, he moved into the North with labor laws until his eventual untimely death.
So I've often seen his critique as having sort of two dimensions to it. And I'd be interested how you see this. On the one hand, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was King that said, 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in American history.
I believe it was Malcolm X, but I'm not too sure if that is.
Well, maybe they were mimicking each other. Where you see the church, the temple, as you referred to it, mm-hmm. as itself having broken the covenant. So Christian communities themselves had failed, not only failed to live up to it, but become pitted against it to some extent. So this critique of the church was mm-hmm. was a big factor for him.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the critique of the church, it's also indicative of the sort of tension that happened between the laity, the church-going members, and the church leaders. In my research, there's also seems to be quite a bit of tension there that speaks to there was an earnest attempt by many church leaders to endeavor to support the civil rights movement, to endeavor to have this equality and the end of segregation more directly. In earnest by these church leader groups. But in the South, these church leaders could face basically expulsion by their denominations.
And by the community.
And by the community at large.
Yeah.
And in the North, it was much easier to be prophetic from a distance than it was to be actually in the community. So there does seem to be a tension, but that tension is also guided a lot by many of the faith seemed to be at odds on the issue.
Yeah. You had these divisions right down the center of churches.
Mm-hmm.
But he was remarkably successful in actually calling forth religious people. Protestants, Catholics, Jews, particularly, and marshaling their energy to work in that other sphere, which is the civil sphere, and to seek to change laws.
Mm-hmm.
So the huge marches that he led, which brought thousands of people together.
Absolutely.
And which established a solidarity mm-hmm. between the black people of the South and lots of white folks from the North that got on the bandwagon.
Right.
And joined in.
I think it's helpful, I mean, when we're talking about the legislative upshot of the civil rights movement, to briefly discuss what the community, particularly the black community, was trying to redress. So we have, after the end of the Civil War, we have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. The 13th Amendment ends segregation, ostensibly. The 14th Amendment is due process under law. No one can deprive somebody of property or liberty, and states that were to do so had to be checked federally. And the 15th Amendment, which promises voting rights. And these were all promised right after, in the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. But as the Reconstruction period, as people know, it did not live up to all the promises and lofty ideals that was originally set out.
So this is not 1865 mm-hmm. to about when?
Well, the Reconstruction period is following the Civil War till, I would say, death of Lincoln was, I have it right here, just a moment. I would say that it's st- started till about 1877. And
so that's really a little over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when there was a concerted effort, the change in legislation, to redress these matters. And then what happened?
Yeah, so we had basically the end of the Reconstruction period, which tried to, one, have the seceded states back in the Union and address their concerns, and also try and have a unified system of rights that was for everyone, not just whites.
And insisted upon at the federal level,
mm-hmm,
even if it was viewed at the state level to be problematic.
Right. Exactly. And then we get what we have in the South is Jim Crow laws. So because of concessions made to Southern Democrats, we have a system and corpus of law that is put in place that essentially gives, it provides protection for a white hierarchy through segregation laws. Plessy versus Ferguson basically codifies this into existence.
That was a court case.
Yes. Yeah. Which basically...
what was the heart of that?
Plessy versus Ferguson basically refers to a legal case that assessed the constitutionality of the segregation laws that were put in place in the Jim Crow period. It basically gave a constitutional precedent to laws designed to achieve said racial segregation. And that was to do with a separate car act. So people had to take trains and separate cars based on their race. And the Supreme Court heard that case and basically protected and ratified rules that would animate the segregationist period all the way up into the civil rights movement.
And it happened fast. What year was Plessy versus Ferguson?
It was in 1896. So this is following years and years of concessions to Southern Democrats, who, after the Civil War, there's this, the lost cause theory, basically. And
what's the lost cause theory?
The lost cause theory is that the South that seceded from the Union basically had no chance to begin with, but they, you know, they pulled together and did it anyway for the sake of states' rights and to defend their homeland, and it was all very, it was almost like a myth. That was provided to basically assuage and alleviate the division between the South and the North, and also to alleviate the egos of the lost party.
So the white power brokers in the South sought legal ways of pushing back,
mm-hmm,
against what the federal policies were.
Well, the tension always seemed to be states' rights versus federal rights. So, mm-hmm, and the beginning, particularly during the end of the Reconstruction era and the beginning of the sort of Jim Crow era, there was a slate of Supreme Court decisions that basically ratified the ability of the South to govern their own affairs and essentially provide for a racial hierarchy within their states, something that was so deeply important to them.
So interesting, isn't it, the role of the Supreme Court when we think of what's going on right now. Absolutely. With the Supreme Court in the United States. So this is not a new story.
No.
What we're witnessing
the
today.
The composition matters.
This is moving back and forth and back and forth over that time. Why is it called Jim Crow?
Jim Crow is an old minstrel character that was basically, it's an epithet for this goofy minstrel black character that was like a traveling act in the South and in the North as well. But it was, you know, it was blackface, very expressed and overdone makeup. Tropes were employed, racist imagery, very much that put them in this, the image that put Jim Crow was in a sort of goofy, subservient position. And that went on to animate what happened in the South.
Mm-hmm. So then we come to the beginnings of the modern civil rights movement.
Right.
People like King, many others. One of the striking things to me about Martin Luther King as a political leader is that he, and I'd be interested if how you see this, it seems to me that he was very grounded as an American. He really saw America, as many Americans do, as the national myth of America is. This is the new city on the hill. This is a unique country,
mm-hmm.
that the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, are all about equality across the board. So he was seeking to call Americans not away from who he saw or for what he saw their foundational myth to express, but rather to live it out.
Right.
To make it possible.
Right.
For all men to be equal, all women to be equal.
Certainly. And like, I think he was very much influenced, as we were just talking in the Civil War with Lincoln. Lincoln used to say that the United States was the last best hope on earth. This idea, this new republic, this experiment of constitutional democracy, that was being very much felt by King, who studied in his theological school. He would ground much of his rhetoric in that idea of history, in that idea of this destiny that needs to be fulfilled by the American people. And these unfulfilled promises of the Emancipation Proclamation, of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, of the original founding fathers' idea of every man being created equal, the shining city on the hill.
Yeah. What was Lincoln's religious formation like? You looked at that a little bit, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Lincoln is an interesting character because he was raised in the anti-slavery Baptist ethos in Kentucky as he was growing up. But his
and in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As he moved around, he was articulating his religious beliefs weren't fully articulated. When he was a young man, he was secular in a lot of his understanding. But as he grew older, and particularly as when he became the president, he grounded much of his political rhetoric in religious understanding.
And in that prophetic tradition.
Absolutely.
That you mentioned.
Yeah. Not content to allow the South to continue, rather force the issue, and basically bring about change through the beginning of the Civil War.
And Lincoln has often struck me as such a remarkable politician as well, because after he was elected, he also brought his rivals into his cabinet. So his sense of human dignity included his rivals. So even those that had fought against him and deeply, this deeply contested world, Elizabeth Kearns Goodwin, the great American presidential historian, wrote a lovely book called The Team of Rivals, showing how he brought them in. And to my mind, this has always struck me as being the fruit of both his sense that we need to make America, we have to open America for blacks, but that to him also meant I must call forward the dignity of my opponents, and I must seek to weave them into this, to make this work. So he was crossing boundaries,
mm-hmm.
dramatically crossing boundaries. And it's always charmed me, given that I lived in the States in the 60s, that Lincoln, of course, was a Republican.
Absolutely.
And the Southern Democrats were a big issue around the Jim Crow laws.
Absolutely.
So these party pre-perspectives are not firm at all. They're moving around all the time.
Oh, yeah. The Dixiecrats and the Republicans sort of switched places during that period.
Yeah.
There was much the change in that regard to what you were saying with bringing in this sort of mass, this large tent that Lincoln did following the Civil War. Martin Luther King actually followed in the same tradition.
Yeah.
He tried to broaden the tent as wide as possible and tried to make the movement as wide as possible by offering out his hand to people who are of all colors and all walks of life to walk hand in hand and basically to oppose this idea of segregation and racial inequality more broadly. He wasn't a black nationalist. He wasn't exclusionary in his movement, but rather he wanted to, particularly in near the end of his life, he wanted to broaden his message to include not only racial inequality, but economic inequality, which is something that is definitely a broad message, particularly in the era and today.
I recall in Chicago in the 60s, following this a little bit, I think everybody who was in the States at this time remembers where they were when Jack Kennedy was assassinated and then when Martin Luther King was assassinated. And of course, the Vietnam War was in the front of our minds, many of us who were down there at the time. And the Vietnam War, the whole selective service system in the United States, which required that once you reached 18, I believe it was, all American citizens and anybody that had a green card, I had a green card, had to sign up to the selective service system. You had to sign up for what's called the draft. And the Vietnam War was perking away a little bit, and then it started to heat up. And you could get exemptions if you went to university.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get very good exemptions if you said you were going to be going to divinity school and you were going to become a clergy person. That gave you a 4D classification, which meant the selective service system was going to just leave you alone. You could go through your university education, you could go to seminary, and you wouldn't have to serve. For that reason, there were a lot of young men, your age now, I suppose, who, for reasons which one would wonder about, decided they wanted to become clergy people. It was the most convenient way of avoiding the draft. You didn't have to claim to have a bone spur.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to mutilate yourself in some fashion,
mm-hmm.
Which some did, in order to avoid the draft. But then in part, because of King's movement, and King began to speak about this, look what we're doing. We've got the war, but who's going?
Right.
The vast majority of people that were drafted were from the poor communities, the poor black communities in America.
Right.
Now, there are exceptions to that. There are black men that went and rose up the ranks, became very significant. But the frontline soldiers were largely from poor black communities and poor white communities with none of the advantages of the middle class, much less the upper classes. So for King, this became really apparent. And my memory is, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, you've hinted at it already, that he begins to shift a little bit and say, of course, race is a big matter, but it is, am I fair in saying that he began to see race as a kind of subset of poverty?
Oh, absolutely. The degradation of the poor was a massive issue for King, and it was a massive unifying issue for King. Most of what he conceived as racial politics was conceived as a class issue. Yeah. And King understood that during his protests and during his marches for fair housing and economic justice, which was much of his protest after desegregation in the South. As he moved to the North, these issues started to become more articulated.
And that is why I suppose many people who opposed him began to think of him as a Marxist. Mm-hmm. And the whole trope, Cold War trope of communism, began to be assigned to anybody who was involved in the struggles for racial equality, the struggles against Vietnam War, and what have you.
J. Edgar Hoover had quite a big file on him.
He had a big file on him. He did, indeed. Another element of Dr. King's approach and method was his understanding of nonviolence. Where did that come from?
Well, his operational technique of nonviolence and civil disobedience broadly came from Gandhi, his understanding of the movement that happened in India, the decolonization of India via nonviolent civil disobedient methods that were employed by Gandhi. This animated his understanding of how the civil rights movement was employed not only through King, but through the student movement, who was also studying this and used the act of civil disobedience and collective action and economic disruption to basically put a halt to the everyday social goings on and bring attention to the issue without delegitimizing it through violence.
I saw a tension arise in the black community at that period around this matter, because there was another movement that developed, the founding of the black Muslim movement and the emergence of somebody like Malcolm X, who also had a remarkable rhetorical gift and was a fine thinker. And Malcolm X, as I recall, do I recall this correctly? He actually entered the Black Muslim movement while he was in prison at one point. The Nation of Islam. And he's a fascinating figure, and he and King sparred with each other a bit over the issue of violence and over the issue of black nationalism.
Yeah. Well, Malcolm X was much more of a firebrand, for sure. He used the idea, well, he was a black nationalist in his original conception and believed that there could be no agreement with these white slave masters, and this hierarchy that has been established is fixed. And essentially, there's this Back to Africa movement that comes about. There is black nationalism that conceives that blacks should basically, they should not rely on the forbearance of white people to allow them to demand and redress these laws that were unequal in society. Hit towards the end of his life, because there was a lot of tension with him and Martin Luther King over this issue. Towards the end of his life, it's been said that he softened this stance and came to see things as a little more broadly in terms of Martin Luther King's conception of the issue.
My understanding of this is that Malcolm X began to study Islam, and he realized that the Nation of Islam, defining itself as Islam over against Christianity, which was understood by them to be a white man's religion,
mm-hmm.
and the religion of the oppressor. Malcolm X began to study Islam, and then he went on the Hajj. He took the pilgrimage to Mecca. And my memory is that while he was in Mecca on the pilgrimage, and that's an amazing ritual event. There are all kinds of rituals that are done in Mecca. But everybody that goes to Mecca dons a white garment. You're a Haji. Everybody on the Hajj dresses the same, no matter what their social status is. And they all participate, in a sense, as equals in that event. It goes back to this notion that comes out of the prophet Abraham, that ringing the changes, of course, on the beautiful text in Genesis, that God has created the human being in his image and likeness. And all human beings share the same origins. So all human beings share in a kind of divine dignity. And Malcolm X in Mecca sees the whole of the human family there, because the House of Islam, Dar es Salaam, like Christianity, is a universal religion. So there were people from Somalia, people from Asia, people from Bosnia-Herzegovina. You had white people, brown people, Asians. He sees the whole human family there.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes back from there, he recognizes that the Nation of Islam had structured itself around racism, around race, instead of around being created by God, no matter how you looked. So this shifted dramatically his understanding, and I think leads to his assassination.
Yeah. There's the idea of this cosmopolitan characteristic of faith definitely permeates Martin Luther King's understanding as well. And Christianity is this big tent understanding. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So there are several other figures that emerge, and you have looked at them a little bit. But first of all, Reinhold Niebuhr.
Mm-hmm.
Reinhold Niebuhr, as I think I've said to you before, for me, remains one of the great, if not the greatest,
sort of social critic that America has given us. He's out of the German Lutheran tradition. He is initially a Protestant liberal and studied at Union Theological Seminary, ended up serving a poor church in Detroit. And he is a remarkable, he's first of all, he writes so remarkably.
But you've met him in this work, I believe.
Absolutely.
How's he struck you?
Well, his practice of Christian realism and his sort of clear-eyed version of the faith influences a lot of civil rights figures. His emphasis on the sinful condition of man, particularly pride, and its tendency to actualize itself through human achievements, particularly where claims of religious or political perfection are made, sort of demurred this prevailing notion of assured Christian idealism, because King drew from Niebuhr in the sense that people weren't content to simply allow this psychological tension to eventually have an impact on people's consciousness to desegregate or to end this racial hierarchy that exists. Like King drew from Niebuhr in the sense that there needed to be immediate action, prophetic action, to bring about this change. And this change comes with an acknowledgement of the sinful condition within us all, that sinful condition of pride. Interestingly enough, Niebuhr conceived race prejudice as a form of group pride, rooted in the instincts of survival and expressed through fears of miscegenation and mixed race, mixed race education hindering white children. So there was this fear among parents that their kids were somehow going to fall behind, or that there was going to be this the idea of purity among these communities was being challenged by this mixed race education laws, and it's obviously this signified a greater anxiety over a broader decline over the white race.
Sounds like today, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? The echo that this has in our own day. Another person that I know you've thought about a little bit, and she's one of the people that I treasure, and I'd like you to just reflect on her a little bit, is Dorothy Day. Dorothy Day, who's an artist, hung around with a lot of artists, and ends up, she's a communist, and she ends up undergoing a transformation. But that transformation just deepens her capacity for social criticism.
Yeah.
Was Dorothy Day a surprise for you?
Dorothy Day was a surprise. She's lived such an interesting life. She was a bon vivant sort of figure who was definitely a Marxist communist at the beginning of her understanding, and turned into a Catholic and an anarchist at the end.
Yeah.
So she's lived, she's donned many hats, but her theology centered on this idea of personalism, which emphasized like the value and dignity of every individual as they call towards a more equitable society, and being in congress with the poor, and being and providing the idea of opening up your house and opening up your home, the culture of welcome. This was very much when she set up these houses all over the United States, these houses of
friendship.
Friendship, yeah. So she was her ideals were very grounded in class and the idea of this sort of degradation of the poor and how to solve that through love and through understanding. And
you know, there's an amazing text in the gospel. It's Matthew 25, which is often referred to as the gospel of the last judgment, where Jesus tells this kind of story about how on the last day, the sheep and the goats will gather before the king, and he will separate them, the goats on the left, the sheep on the right. And in the gospel text, he turns to the people on the left, and he says to them, "Depart from me into," the language sounds harsh on the surface, mm-hmm. "into eternal damnation. For when I was hungry, you did not feed me. When I was naked, you did not clothe me. When I was sick and imprisoned, you did not visit me." And they will say, "But Master, when did we see you naked? When did we see you hungry? When did we see you sick and imprisoned?" And the rabbi from Nazareth says to them, "When you did not see me in the least of these, my little ones," that is, when you did not see a hungry, naked, imprisoned person, when you did not see them and respond to them, you did not respond to me. And they say, "Well, if we knew it was you, of course we would have." And then he turns to the people on the right. It's so interesting how this narrative works. And he says to them, "Come to the banquet table. Enter the joy of God's kingdom. For when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was sick and imprisoned, you visited me. Enter the kingdom of God."
Mm.
And they will say, "No, no, 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 no. We're not good enough for that. When did we see you hungry? When did we see you naked? When did we see you sick and imprisoned?" And he says, "Every time you saw one of these, my little ones, who were hungry, naked, imprisoned, and you responded to them, you responded to me." So this text became very central text. It's a central text to many, many Christians. And it is an example of the way in which Jesus makes use, the rabbi 2,000 years ago from Nazareth, drawing on the prophetic tradition that you've talked about,
mm-hmm.
and saying, this isn't simply something about the past. This is about the reality of our life together. And my own reading of this text and what some see as the harsh language in the text, I often, Callum, when I read that text, I don't hear the voice of a judge. I hear Jesus Christ weeping and saying to the people on the left, "Why? Why didn't you realize that these were your brothers and sisters?
Right.
Why didn't you realize that these people share in the human dignity? Why didn't you realize that all these people are the image of God? You, by not realizing that, created hell, the hell of estrangement, the hell of your own making." And right. then turning to the others and saying, this isn't some kind of ideological social justice doctrine. This is about human dignity. It's more profound than a social justice doctrine.
Oh, totally. And it's the idea of radical love that Dorothy Day practiced in her everyday life.
Yeah.
This idea when she was a part of the Catholic workers movement that operated on this principle of subsidiarity with the poor, the importance of living simple and humbly with them. and understanding them and being around them and not casting them into this, as you say, casting them into this idea of the other.
She also was, of course, deeply concerned about the war. She had seen some of the effects, the echoes of the First World War and the effects of the Second. And so I recall that when in the United States, in the face of the Cold War, they installed air raid sirens around all the cities. And they did that here in Canada, too. I remember it from my elementary school days in the 50s. And there was all the fear of nuclear weapons as well. So it was very palpable. And all of the enormous Cold War rhetoric that was so common, fear of Russia, fear of communism, seeing communists around every corner. And then, of course, Dorothy Day, there was a law in the United States that when the air raid sirens went off at 11 o'clock on, I can't recall what day it was, Tuesday or something like that, once a month or once a week, I don't recall, you were obliged to seek shelter. If you were on the street, you had to seek shelter. You had to go down into a subway station or things like that. Dorothy Day, in her inimitable fashion, led the people from Friendship House in New York on a regular fashion out to Central Park and sat down in Central Park just in time for those air raid sirens to go off and had a picnic. Because Dorothy Day saw this as the propaganda of fear, that this is simply cultivating fear in us, and it's stereotyping part of the world, and we've got to challenge it by simply not obeying. So she also had a strong sense of passive resistance.
Absolutely.
To the culture of fear.
And also the prevailing culture of her contemporaries. She was seen as, her Catholic faith was seen by her communist compatriots as needlessly oppressive. And her more socialist understanding and nonviolent understanding and pacifist understanding was seen as rather loopy from her more conservative religious compatriots. So she walked her own path, and her idea of nonviolence was even in the Second World War was animated her understanding, which was not the prevailing thing. It was not the prevailing idea. It was a out of fashion to be so anti-war. And yet she, again, practiced this idea of radical love and pacifism above all else.
Yeah, and I appreciate the fact that you highlight how she was the subject of serious criticism, both from her longstanding secular socialist and communist friends, who never really could figure out why she entered the Catholic Church, and then also from a constituency of Catholics and other Christians who saw her as, a pinko,
right.
siding with communism because she's resisting the culture of fear. To my mind, that's, I've often said that if both sides are critical of you, then maybe you've got something right.
Mm-hmm.
You're really listening to a different drummer. You're not buried in the silos that have divided up the world. You're trying to find a way to bring things together, to call people together out of their estrangement into a new kind of relationship.
Truly. I was listening to a gentleman who worked for her for years, and just to highlight her more polemic understanding, he asked her, how do you square your Catholic faith with your belief in anarchism? And she gave him a perplexed look, and she's like, well, it's always worked for me.
So what do you think she means by anarchism?
Anarchism broadly is you have to justify systems of authority. So I'd imagine, and particularly in the day, that this she more conceived anarchism in the prism of class. These oppressive systems, economic systems that degradate the poor and leave people with less opportunity. So her idea of anarchism and justifying these systems of authority, I believe, is conceived through the idea of class. Because when we look at anarchism and the idea of the Catholic Church, which is based on a system of laws and obviously hierarchies, it becomes much harder to square. But I don't believe that's she aimed these beliefs particularly at that system of class.
She's a 20th century saint in my mind. I have such affection for her. And I'm not surprised. You know, she was in many ways, a conservative Catholic. You know, she knew the Berrigans, for example, who were deeply involved in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. Both of them were Jesuit priests. But she saw the changes that came out of the Second Vatican Council and the way in which those were fielded by certain clergy and other Catholics, where they became a little cavalier around some of the way in which liturgy and the sacraments were handled within the church. She was quite conservative about things like that, and yet she had this radical notion, this notion of radical love, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And Catholicism is so interesting in America because, and it differs a lot from many of the Protestant denominations, because many Protestant denominations become sort of the chapel of a particular class or the chapel of a particular ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
Catholicism is a huge tent. And so there's always been poor as well as wealthy, educated and not, within the Catholic world. So Catholic churches to this day, I mean, even here in Edmonton, if you were to go to the cathedral, the basilica here in Edmonton, you'd be struck by how diverse the congregation is. When Dorothy Day departed this world, and may her memory be eternal, when she departed this world, John Cardinal O'Connor, the tough, quite brilliant Cardinal of New York, who himself had been raised in a military family and was a key chaplain to the American military, and who Dorothy Day had gone, like the prophets, to his office and read the Riot Act to him on occasion, like argued with him about what the church ought to be doing and how we ought to be addressing these things.
Mm-hmm.
When Dorothy Day departed this world, within a very short time after that, John Cardinal O'Connor put forward her cause for sainthood, which is a formal procedure in the Roman Catholic Church. I think I have that correct from my memory of it.
You do.
They were certainly seen as very opposite in many ways. Cardinal O'Connor, as a man, a significant man, concerned primarily with defending the institutions of the church. Dorothy Day, very serious, concerned with the ministry of the church, seeing that this ministry, as reflected in Matthew 25, that's the way we ought to be carrying forward our life in the world. We aren't really the proper church unless we're doing that. So her anarchism, I mean, I'll just suggest this to you, that her anarchism strikes me as being very central to how the Christian tradition understands our common life in the world. It's not that institutions aren't important and significant. They are. But it all goes back to this other encounter that Jesus has with a lawyer, where the lawyer says to him in the gospel, you know, there's this incident about looking at a coin and whose image is on the coin. Well, Caesar's image is on the coin. So Jesus, in this encounter, says, well, render to Caesar's what is Caesar's, but to God what is God's. Now, there's a tension in that, because both in Judaism and in Christianity, God is the creator of the world. Caesar is a ruler of a little piece. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I mean, there's a huge debate about this in Christian thought. Yes, you respect Caesar, but you do not worship Caesar.
Right.
You don't burn incense to Caesar. And Caesar is subject to the implications of the gospel. When Caesar acts in such a way to diminish widows and orphans, to diminish blacks, to diminish anyone, then you are like Jeremiah and Isaiah, out of the center of your faith, as Dorothy Day understood this better than so many. You are responsible to act, and that act has to take two forms. One, it has to be a doing. She creates Friendship House. She models it. She does it. King did some of that too. But it also requires you to speak the sobering word to those who are in power, whether they're in the church, Cardinal O'Connor, or whether they're the president of the United States or the governor of a state.
Right.
You've got to do both and.
Mm-hmm. I always found it interesting to regarding her idea of state overreach. She conceived the social assistance as sop thrown to the poor in her understanding. So this very socialist understanding is at tension with, and her more socialist politics are at tension with, the idea of the social safety net. As she saw it, as she conceived it, it was government state overreach. And obviously perhaps she conceived it as her role is to be more direct through the church rather than being direct through the state, through social assistance and what have you. I always just found that an interesting tension. And it alienated her amongst her more leftist compatriots.
Yeah, it's good that you bring that up, because that's also a ubiquitous tension within Christian thought and within Christian churches. Typically, liberals want the state to do everything. So you have a social safety net, you have professions of social workers, etc. Whereas on the more conservative side, you want to say, well, the state can do some things, but when it comes to care, like real care, we have an obligation to have our skin in the game. She opened her door to the poor.
Right.
She lived with them. So there's this tension in the Christian tradition around this issue. My own father was a socialist, quite suspicious of business and wealthy people. But at the same time, he really knew that the proper living out of the Christian vocation is one that doesn't outsource our relationship to the poor or to people who are in trouble. We need to be in solidarity with them. We need to live together. Live together. And she had a very firm sense of this. But that's another example of how, when you are really radical, you get a kicking from both sides.
Oh man, did she ever? Did she ever? Yeah, she also had some pretty interesting understanding with the Cuban Revolution. She was a fervent supporter, and as many people would conceive that as the Cuban Revolution was, as she supported in earnest, caused much suffering as well.
Yeah, so much of this is an issue of what do you support in the moment,
mm-hmm.
and how then does that live itself out?
Absolutely.
And of course, the great example of this would be Bolshevism, which in its ideological conception with Karl Marx, it's hard for me to imagine that somebody who is committed to serve to the poor and the alienated and to that ministry wouldn't be inclined to support that. But mm-hmm. look how it's lived out.
Right.
It creates a bureaucratic nightmare instead of deeper solidarity between people. Well, we should find time to also think about this, what you've been looking at here and some of the elements of it, and just bringing into a little bit of a dialogue with where you see, because you pay attention to what's going on in the United States and Canada now, we should have a conversation again about where the echoes are mm-hmm. in our current situation, both in the United States and Canada, and have that conversation as a bit of a bridge. And then we will also have a third one, I trust, where we explore Christian nationalism. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Martin Luther King was a witness to both the diseases of racism and poverty and to the aspiration at the foundations of American society. He was a witness in both senses of that word, to see and to testify. He saw the awful landscape that emerges when we deny human dignity. He testified to the divine image in all human beings, how it calls us toward making a more perfect union. It is lovely to see how learning about and understanding this unfolding chapter in the history of the Americas has come to fruition in Kellum and his attentiveness to this call. Please join me in the next two conversations with Kellum. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.